In today's episode, Maka and Nwabisa meet Lovelin. Lovelin describes herself as a trusted advisor. She is a Nigerian individual who grew up in South Africa and has meandered her way to live in the Netherlands. We dig deeper into the notion of trust and its importance when driving for humans to do right by each other. Lovelin takes us through some examples of her work experiences, and let's just say that you might find yourself doing a lot of research after this episode. Let us know what you learn. Keep rocking. Welcome to another episode of She Rocks Global. My name is Nwabisa, and I'm coming to you from Cape Town. Hello, Maka.
Hello, Nwabisa. How are you today?
I'm good to have you in the room, or at least in the virtual room, and it's always fun to be in interviews with you. Today, we have a very special guest, as all of our guests are, a rocking woman by the name of Lovelin. And without further much ado, I think it's, as all of our episodes, it's probably best to rather leave it to Lovelin to introduce herself. So welcome, Lovelin. Thank you for your time. And please tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you want us to know about you today.
Hi, thank you for having me. Oh my gosh, how do I introduce myself? Okay, so as you've said, my name is Lovelin Wade. I am a Nigerian South African, so born in Nigeria, grew up in South Africa. And the journey and meandering of my life has landed me in a place where I care a lot about social justice. I care a lot about society. And I care a lot about humans doing right by each other. So some people will call me a speaker. Some people will call me an activist. I like to think of myself as a trusted advisor. And that's really how I try to position myself in the work that I do. And even in the relationships that I have with people. So that is me in a nutshell.
That is incredible. And where are you coming to us from today? Because I think part of your meanders mean that you're not necessarily in Nigeria and you're not necessarily in South Africa today. So where have you meandered to?
In this current moment, I've meandered my way into Amsterdam. So I'm coming to you from the Netherlands, Amsterdam city in the Netherlands, and it's a beautiful day. So we're still in winter, but today the sun decided to come out to play. And it's quite a treat, actually. I'm really enjoying the sunshine today.
The nice thing is that Maka is in Uruguay. I'm in South Africa, which means we're definitely in sunshine at the moment. So it's nice to know that all three of us in today's conversation are in the sunshine. Maka, I think you have a question for Lovelin.
Yes, because for a start, she introduced herself as a trusted advisor. And I want you to share with us, how do you understand trust?
Oh, wow. How do I understand trust? Just go into it. Okay. So I think when I think about trust, trust has to do with knowing that, let's start with trust between people. Yeah. I think for me, trust is that quality of knowing that a person will still tell you the truth, even when you don't like what they're going to say, even when they might be afraid to say what they need to say. But you know that it's coming from a place that is deeply committed to maintaining connection and maintaining relationship. So I think for me, trust is that quality that allows us to be in relationship and be connected to each other whilst we butt heads, whilst we disagree, whilst we get frustrated and irritated with each other, but there's something about the overall commitment to staying connected to each other that allows us to push through that moment. So for me, trust is that, like, I don't trust people in my life who can't give me feedback. I really don't. Like, if you are a yes person, like everything I say, you're like, yes, I think that's great. I think that's wonderful. I really struggle to trust those people, not because I don't like having like cheerleaders in my corner. I think all of us love having cheerleaders in our corner and we should have people who support us. But I mean, none of us are that great. You know, everyone has something about them that they need their friends, their colleagues, their loved ones to every now and then just bring to their attention. So I think at an interpersonal level, trust for me is that quality that's like I can really rely on you to tell me things, even things that I don't like, to speak the truth, even when it's going to be difficult and tricky to do so.
That's powerful.
And so that is, and that's a very helpful definition. I think I'm also starting to think about, where do I sit with my relationship with staying connected to people, but being able to receive and give feedback, even if it's a bit scary. And so you're a trusted advisor, self-described trusted advisor. And so oftentimes, what is it that you find yourself, or at least you offer yourself as an advisor to and about?
Yeah, I mean, I think even you're right. I mean, it's also, it's like one of those things when someone says I'm so humble, it can sound somehow. so I'm definitely not saying I'm so humble. I think, you know, it's also things that have been said to me that make me quite confident to speak about myself as a trusted advisor. So when I'm often asked for advice or brought in, a lot of the times it has to do with situations that have a lot of complexity. Complexity around human relationships and complexity around those relationships, particularly in the spaces of how our identities are shaping the way that we relate. So to put it like really concretely, you know, a lot of my work has taken place in schools and in corporates, especially in South Africa, where, you know, as much as we are a country with an incredible journey, and there are success stories to be proud of, there's still a lot that South Africa is navigating as it relates to race, to gender, to homophobia, xenophobia, how we treat immigrants, etc. And so where those issues have come to a head in educational spaces, in workplaces, I've often been brought in to support in helping leaders to like take a step back and figure out what's the best way for us to handle that. And so that's where I tend to lean into those conversations and offer perspective. And I guess to my earlier point, where the trusted advisorship comes in there is because those are not the kinds of scenarios where you can only affirm and only smile your way through those conversations. Those are often very tough conversations. So I remember, for example, in 2020, obviously, it was still, you know, in the pandemic, but there was a lot of, I call it feedback. Other people call it a sensationalism, but there was a lot of feedback coming from past and present students of some of the most prestigious, and I use prestigious in inverted commas, of some of the most prestigious schools in South Africa, where their alumni, but even some of their current students, were writing and sharing experiences of racism, of sexism, of homophobia that they had when they were in these schools. And I mean, some of these stories went as far back as pre-94, so like your first set of kids who were allowed to go to these formerly whites-only schools. And then you had like recent examples, as recent as like children who matriculated in 2017, 2018, 2019. And these were harrowing stories of how, you know, these individuals as children felt that the schools, the educators that were responsible for them were not fulfilling their duty of care towards them by allowing certain experiences of racism, et cetera, to happen to them. And being asked to come into those scenarios and support these school leaders was very hard and very heavy. And in those scenarios, you've got to speak the truth, right? You've got to say, we know this is terrible, and we know this obviously looks bad from a PR perspective, but this is not a reputation management conversation that we need to have. This is a repair conversation. This is a rebuilding conversation. And this is also a renewal conversation, like where we've got to tell the truth about who we are as a country, who we are as a society, and who we can be if we lean into the discomfort and the awkwardness and the embarrassment and the shame that this moment brings. So those, I mean, that's just like one example, but I mean, that's an example where you can't say yes to everything, and people know when they bring me into a room I will speak the truth. And I mean, when I say truth, of course, truth is relative to different people. But for me, I will speak what my conscience will allow me to sleep with, right? Like, for me, that's my truth, is that I will tell you what I'm seeing. I will tell you where I think you're doing well. I will tell you where I think you really missed the mark. And hopefully the people on the receiving end know that I'm saying that because I'm still committed to maintaining relationship and connection. But to do that, we've got to have some honesty.
This podcast is all about talking to women who rock. A Team Who Rocks are the production company based in Cape Town who helped make it happen. They're called 400 Seats. And if you're nurturing a great idea, they can help bring it to life. From video production to podcasts and from concept right through to editing, they'll help make your content unskippably good. Take a seat with them by visiting 400seats.com.
And so I guess my question around that would be, there is establishing trust between people within the conversation that is happening. How do you find the ability to trust yourself in that conversation?
Oh my gosh, I think my internet's just broke because you asked that question. Oof. That is such a hard question. How do I learn to trust myself? You know, to be honest, I think that's been a journey. It really has been a journey coming to a place where I trust my own voice. In principle, you know, at the end of the day, I have to sit with, like, if what I've said in this space comes out 20 years from now, 30 years from now, would I still stand by what I said? So I don't mean that in like the arrogant, like you've got new information and you're still refusing to like change your mind. I mean, in terms of like, would my values still be aligned to what I've said or what I've done? And that's a big part of learning to trust myself is like, can I look myself in the mirror and still live with myself? Can I go to bed at night? And if saying or doing something aligns with that, then I'm good, you know? So that's the one way that I navigate this conversation about learning to trust myself. And also just like, I think, you know, and I don't want to get too like esoteric and spiritual about it, but I do as an individual, like I really think learning to trust our bodies is important. There's something about how we feel in our bodies when we do and say certain things. And I always try to take that as my guide. So, you know, of course, like you will have nerves and you'll have emotions, and I think that's normal. But there will be certain moments where like you can feel like your own sense of integrity in your gut, in your chest, in your tummy. You know, like I have that sense. And in fact, I have had moments where I didn't listen to myself and I didn't trust myself. And I felt that sense of like shame and betrayal of self. I have felt that in my body as well. You know, I remember one particular client that I worked with. It was a school. And when they first called me in, I remember after the first meeting with them thinking, I don't know, hey, like I'm not sure that this is that just something didn't feel genuine about their interaction with me. And I've had this sometimes where I guess because of my reputation, people will often bring me into those kinds of crises almost to put the rest of the community at bay, like, don't worry, we've got Lovelin. And then people are like, okay, we trust Lovelin, so we know the situation is handled. So this was one of those scenarios where even though like I knew that people in that community trusted me, the conversation with the leaders, I was just like, something was off. But of course, in the name of not disappointing people that trusted me, I thought, let me push through. And I remember after my first 4 days of being at that place, I literally remember like for a week afterwards, my feet were heavy. Like I couldn't, it's so weird. Like I couldn't walk properly. Like every time I took a step, my feet were so heavy. And it felt like a signal from my body of like, stop, get out of here. What are you doing here? like to the point that like my body itself was slowing me down and like moving around in that space and coming out of that space, you know. So I think that's a big part of learning to trust oneself, and also to just like believe in our experiences. I think a big part of the experience of holding a marginalized or minoritized identity. So in my case, you know, growing up Black, but also growing up as an immigrant, you know, growing up, I often talk about our family as being middle class adjacent. Like we were definitely not wealthy, but we never went to bed hungry. But you knew like one crisis you're one crisis away from poverty. Growing up in that kind of middle class adjacent anxiety, all those things add to this like wobbliness of your own sense of trusting your voice. So I know that that's not an easy thing for people who hold minoritized backgrounds to do. And so it does take practice. And this is where leaning into the wisdom of our bodies and trusting our experiences is how I've learned to navigate that.
Amazing. I imagine that working on these topics or leading this conversation may be very interesting on how you question yourself about how you live your own personal life. Because when you stand out on those communities to facilitate that conversation, and you double click on the body as a compass of what things are going or how we feel. And you talk about inclusion and how we can make, especially on your job, everybody feel comfortable. In which places you can be authentic, Loveling? Like, especially in this kind of jobs, like when you can be yourself for real, like 100%.
I think I'm very blessed that I've got really good friends. Like I have an incredible circle of friends who really are just, you know, it's my chosen family. So I have my people around whom, you know, there is no pretense. There are no airs. There's no mask. And I think I'm very lucky in that sense that I've got a really good circle of friends that I love and trust deeply, and that I can be completely authentic and safe and honest with. And so for me, that's sort of the spaces where I can have that authenticity. And I think, you know, especially in this work, that's really important because we don't do this work in isolation, right? Like whilst you do the work of social justice, like people who do social justice work outside of community, I'm also quite suspicious about. Because, you know, if we're talking about social justice, we're talking about society. And at the core of any society is connection. Like a society that works requires connection. So I don't think you can do that kind of social work without being connected to people. But of course, I think the temptation or the danger, the danger, I think, of capitalism and the dangers of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I think sometimes we have this, like, I don't want to call it hero worship, but in movements, we like tend to elevate certain people and put them on a pedestal. So the danger of that is that we can sometimes get caught in this thing of needing to be like completely self-reliant or completely self-sufficient. And that's something that I try to resist like very, very intentionally and really open myself up to like be in relationships, stay connected to people. And that's not always easy, but I think it's absolutely worth it.
Thank you for that. And just to build upon that answer, how do you feel technology can help or endangered this kind of authenticity and this kind of connections we need to create to be, so we can all be included and be ourselves all the time?
I don't like that.
I'm sorry, Loveling.
No, don't apologize.
This conversation is getting so interesting that I cannot stop.
No, it's a good question. It's such an interesting one. So I guess it depends on what you define as technology, and I'll tell you why. So I, for example, So I'm not really good at social media, for example, right? Like I have, of course, I have an Instagram account, I have a Facebook account, and every now and then I'll post some nice selfies and I'll post funny memes and I'll share inspirational quotes and things like that. But I'm not, I can't say that I find social media, for example, as a great space for like intentional connection and community. I have found incredible pages on social media that are literally like a daily meditation. So like there are certain pages that I follow because of the just the like I almost want to say the spiritual value that they provide with the stuff that's shared there. But outside of that, like I struggle to think about social media as a space for meaningful connection. I'm not there yet. I know there are other people who've managed to really build intentional community through social media, but personally, I'm not there yet. And I also like, I just can't keep up. It's a lot of work to do like curated content and stuff. Like, I'm tired. But on the other hand, I do think what social media and technology has allowed is an incredible opportunity to think about solidarity and connection within movements beyond borders. So where for me this really stood out and where I really appreciated it. So I think that sometimes, especially in South Africa, I think we can be quite navel gazing in South Africa, where we think about our issues in South Africa as being so special and so unique to us, right? And so then, you know, we get a bit like stuck in our own heads about it. During the Fees Must Fall movement, 2015, 16, what was incredibly powerful in that time actually was being able to connect with student movements in the United States, for example, who were dealing with similar issues on their campuses around race and accessibility and funding. Connecting with student movements and workers' movements in Brazil, in connecting with activists in Palestine. So there's something about technology that allows us to connect across multiple borders, without needing to obviously physically be there, but share in the knowledge and the learnings and the even just navigating some of the complexity, right, that movement spaces bring up. That I really appreciated in that time because what it did as well was to offer a wisdom about how we think about struggle and resistance beyond our own frameworks, like in our own geography. So that for me was incredibly powerful. So, you know, for example, you know, my if I reflect on like the period of 2015 to like 2017, just the authors that I discovered in that time, right? Like just the authors and the thinkers and the intellectuals that informed people's approach to like concepts like decolonization and things like that were mind-blowing for me. Because even though I had a politics background, you know, the university that I went to, bless their souls, did not have a very radical or critical ideological framework through which they taught. So I had quite a conservative political science background in education, but then suddenly, through being connected to different student movements, you're exposed to authors like Paulo Freire, Nelson Maldonado, you know, Oyewumi Oyoronke. You're getting all these incredible names that you're like, where have these people's voices been in my life, you know? So that for me was really helpful and really powerful. So I guess it's a long waffling answer, Macarena, but I think the point is, it's like a both and for me. I'm not like fully sold on technology, but I don't hate it either. Like it's, I have a love-hate relationship with it. Let me put it that way.
And that's okay. I'm going to ask two questions because I'm greedy, and hopefully you'll be able to indulge me on this. So the one is for context for people who are listening to this podcast from around the world, which is, are you able to give some form of what the Fees Must Fall movement is or was or will be? One. And then perhaps building from Macarena's question around social media and connection, is you seem to be making a differentiation between community and movements. Is there an ability for you to maybe articulate what the difference is between a movement and a community, if there is a difference?
Wow. Okay, let me start with the first one. Okay, first one, context for fees must fall. So I'm going to do like a very, very like truncated explanation for people listening. So the fees must fall movement was quite a, I mean, it wasn't necessarily organized in the sense that there was no like central leader who decided on this date we're going to protest. But it was a movement that had expression across multiple campuses in South Africa, university and higher education campuses, where students were protesting and demanding for access to free, quality, decolonized education. So for context, in South Africa, whilst the government does subsidize public education and does subsidize, so public primary and high school education, but even at university levels, our universities do get some subsidies from the government. Given the average income in South Africa, education is still very out of reach for the average South African. Like to be able to pay for and afford a really good education is really the preserve of the upper middle class to like, you know, upper class. So even middle class in South Africa, I think the last statistic I saw was like you'd be earning 15,000 rand a month if you're middle class. And that's not even up to like 70% of the population. Okay. So you've got an education system that, even though it is being subsidized by the state, is still out of reach for the bulk of South Africans. And the bulk of South Africans who cannot access that education are Black. So this adds a race and a class element to the conversation. Given our history, it also then means that if you are not able to access education in South Africa, your chances of moving out of poverty are very limited. So that perpetuates the cycle of intergenerational poverty. So if I'm not mistaken, the last statistics I saw from 2019, where the unemployment rate was at like 50% for people who only had a high school qualification, for graduates, the unemployment rate was just under 3%, right? So still, it's still, graduates are still a small portion of the population, but still, you've got much better chances of getting a job, making a living wage, et cetera, if you've got a university degree. So all of that creates this concoction of perpetual inequality. And students were saying, listen, we need to have free education because that's literally the only way the bulk of this country can get out of poverty, or one of the only ways. But also at the same time, we don't just want an education that centers Western perspectives and Western ideologies. We want an education that is decolonized, which means it is an education that tells us that we here in Africa have knowledge, have ideas, have perspectives that are valuable, that are worth something, that have contributed to this modern world. Because a lot of the education in South Africa is still very European and Americanized. So that's the whole nutshell. This movement did not actually start in 2015. I think I might get the year wrong, but I think as early as 2012, 2013, students at our technical vocational colleges were already protesting about the inaccessible fees. But I think where it came to a head in 2015 were that some of our universities were increasing their fees up to like 10, 12, 13%. And even our mostly or formerly white universities. So I guess this is also where race comes in. When you've got students in formerly white universities protesting, there is a way that, you know, with the bias in our media, it might get a bit more attention. So that's sort of the story. And these protests then did, even though they were led by students, fortunately or unfortunately, there were ways in which the student movement had been, you know, politically infiltrated, unfortunately. But there was also, you know, quite a lot of like ugliness that emerged from this, right? So there was state-sanctioned violence, and there was a lot of police brutality against unarmed students. There was a lot of sort of just state dismissal of, you know, what young people were calling for. And the hilarious part of this is that what young people were asking for is actually what was promised by the ruling party in their manifesto when they took over leadership of the South African government. So that's what the Fees Must Fall movement was about. I hope that gives sort of sufficient context.
It will definitely pique our audience's curiosity, and I hope that everybody will then go find out more for themselves. And thank you for sharing this. And I think it is important to acknowledge that in asking you to share this, we might maybe also be putting you back in a situation that you maybe did not necessarily want to be a part of today. So thank you, though, for pointing out.
All good. So I'm curious about your question about community and movement. I did not realize that I might have been making a distinction there. So I don't think that I was, but I'm happy to think about, like, if there is a difference, what would that be? I guess at the core, I think you can be in community without necessarily being in a movement, but I don't think you can be in a movement without being in community. So I guess by that I mean a community is really just a group of people who agree to be in connection with each other around certain rituals, practices, ways of being, ways of organizing themselves. You know, I think a family can be a community, but like lots of families in a neighborhood can also be a community. A school can be a community. You know, even in workplaces, we can create communities of practice. We can create communities of affinity. So I think communities might not necessarily always have like an intentional goal that is resisting something or fighting against something. I think they might just be spaces that allow for a level of being and experience and connectedness. But I do think what defines a community is that like everyone has a place in a community. So communities will require some level of like, you know, you handle this and I handle that and we handle this. And this, you know, there's a way in which like for that community to work, responsibility, there's a collective responsibility that we all have in maintaining that. When I think about movement, I do think that movements will often have some kind of, for lack of a better term, end goal, or there's something that the movement is created in response to. So if I think about a protest, if I think about the civil rights movement, if I think about the United Democratic Front in South Africa during the anti-apartheid movement, you know, it's often in response to something that has happened or is happening. And often then at the core of what sort of brings people together is this attempt to resist or reject the thing that's being imposed on them in order to create something new or something better or something different. And I think that often then the community that is built in and through movements is because there is this common goal or this common objective that they have together. Movements then that often sort of center hero worship and center like one individual often won't last, or like at some point their objectives are going to be diluted, because I think a core part of being able to sustain a movement is decentralization, where it's not dependent on one person. So that's sort of how I would see it if I were to offer an on-the-spot, not fully intellectual articulation of what the difference is.
And we don't want that. We want Loveland's thoughts on this. And so what you have shared with us is amazing. So thank you very much.
Definitely. And to start wrapping up the conversation, Loveland, I would love the two last questions. The first one is, what frightens you?
Oh, what frightens me? Insects. I really hate insects. No, but I know, aside from insects.
That works as an answer. If you want to step there, it's okay.
No, but it's actually, you know what I'm really scared of? I'm really scared that in 50 years time that I'm still having the same conversations with my grandchildren. Like, I know that, like, I know that the work of social change is continuous, but there's a quality of progression that I would like to see in the conversation. So I know that maybe we might not eradicate racism, sexism, homophobia, religious violence in one lifetime, because people have been battling these things for centuries. But I just feel with the level of sophistication and, I say, development in inverted commas that we've had in this world, I would like the conversation to just move a little bit further, you know, than just like, don't be racist. Like, it's, you know, so I'm scared of that, because I think I'm scared it would just mean that it takes you into a bit of like a nihilistic existential crisis of like, if nothing actually is ever going to change, then should we do this work? Does it matter? Then if nothing means nothing, then, you know, we're all nothing, therefore all just employed and yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it just sends you there. So that's not great. So that's something that I sit with. And I think the second thing that scares me is like really not so much bad leaders, but like societies that, like what it takes for societies to vote in bad leaders. That's something that scares me. Like, I don't know, there's something about the way we have socially engineered our world and our societies that actually makes evil more attractive than good. And that's something I'm always quite nervous and fearful about, like which is why I care so much about education. Because I think like the only way you can almost like re-engineer society, but like not in sinister ways, please, for the listeners, I'm not trying to do any weird stuff. But the only way you can re-engineer society, I think, is when we teach children differently. And we teach them really, really, really just the fundamentals of kindness and empathy and critical thinking. And at the moment, it just feels to me that like, many, 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 many countries are deeply invested in not teaching that. So, yeah.
I'm afraid with you.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, as Maka did preempt, we do need to wrap up this conversation. We probably could have gone on for much longer, but we don't have to. We'll save that for voice notes. Lavlin, what is it that makes you rock? Don't be frightened.
What is it that makes me rock? Oh my goodness. This is so awkward. So I think that I think I'm really good at seeing things from a lot of different vantage points. So I think that the combination of my upbringings, you know, growing up as a Nigerian in South Africa, but also being a child who then becomes Xhosa, you know, and becomes South African, you know, growing up as a Black child, but, you know, going to a whites-only or formerly whites-only school, moving between various class, like social classes, growing up in a very religious context, but also like now being not in a very religious context in my own life. I think those things give me the ability to really see the world from very different perspectives, but also to be adaptable, to adapt to different contexts in a way that I don't think a lot of people have that, the privilege of that level of exposure. So I think that is what makes me rock. And then I think also the fact that like, I deeply care. Like I take things very seriously. It's sometimes too much, but I take the world seriously. I take humanity seriously. I deeply, deeply care about our world and the lives that we are creating, the societies we are building. And I think because of that level of personal investment that I have in this world, it does mean that there's just a different way that I can show up to the work that I do that is not as transactional and as like, okay, well, let's just get the bills paid, you know, as I think it might be for others. So I think that is what makes me rock.
You absolutely rock.
You definitely rock.
Thank you so much for bringing your different perspective into this conversation. Thank you for trusting us with this conversation and for sharing with us. And most certainly, please keep rocking and please look after yourself. Thank you. And thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So good.
She Rocks Global is a podcast collaboration produced by Makarena Botta, Nwabisa Mayema, and Zoya Kukic. This season of She Rocks Global was recorded remotely and was mixed by our partners at 400seats.com. Theme music for this podcast is composed and arranged through a collaboration between South African musician Nosihe and Hannah Sikasa from Germany. Mixing engineer is T Luminous. She Rocks Global is a podcast that showcases the stories of perfectly imperfect women from around the world. You can contact us through our Instagram handle at SheRocksGlobal, #SheRocks. Please do subscribe to our podcast wherever you find your podcasts. Rate and review us too. This makes it easier for people to find us. Thank you. Until next time, keep rocking.